Oh yeah, but I do, you know, I'm going to come to talk about Harold a little bit and talk about some of the themes that are important in his life, and it felt important to try and work with those themes myself as well in this lecture. But I wanted to start with this picture, which the organisers agreed was a jolly picture to start with. Art makes children powerful, an artwork from an artist called Bob and Roberta Smith. And I like it because it's a very jolly reminder of three things for me. Firstly, the need to stay hopeful, that through art, all children can become powerful, in both the political and social sense, as well as in terms of their own expressive and interpretive powers. That through art, they can be powerful together, as well as powerfully themselves. And secondly, a reminder that the arts are, in any case, always transformative. Its raw materials become other. Ideas hatched in the imagination become material. Working together in art changes us. The impact of art lingers and begins. Realities are questioned and reimagined. What is rational becomes intuitive. What is intuitive becomes rational. And there is a proud and long tradition of artists like Bob and Roberta Smith who believe that through the transformation of the arts, social transformations can happen in the world. And thirdly, it reminds me of that wonderful duality of pleasure and protest, poetics and voice, and the aesthetics of humanity. The sense that art both nurtures and girds the spirit. And there is also, I think, in this work, hope that through art, children might become powerful agents in creating a future that may already not exist, and which certainly cannot exist unless we take seriously the role of the arts and humanities in the lives of children and young people. And Bob and Roberta Smith went further. He made art out of a letter that he wrote to Michael Gove in July, on the day that Amy Winehouse died, as it happens. And I thought I'd just read something from this letter. Dear Michael Gove, art, images, artifacts, songs, culture are the principal means by which human beings define themselves. Michael, a look at your tie and shirt combination in images of you online informs me you are not a visually minded person. You do not care how you look. And then later, from birth, human beings seek to understand, find their place in society, and control their worlds. Through looking and understanding, the child interprets the world. Give a child a piece of paper, a brush, and some colour, and you put them in control. Children's art is so appealing because they have no problem with being in control of images. As school progresses, poor teaching in some schools impresses on the child that they are not in control. Not only are they not in control, but they are the most insignificant cog in a system of control in which they may never play an important part. From Galileo to Darwin, from Caravaggio to Amy Winehouse, creativity is rebellion. Creativity is non-acceptance of the status quo and rejection of the academy. Your initiative towards conformity will cause stagnation. Britain is amazing. In cultural, visual, democratic, musical, design, product development and literary terms, Britain is a giant. Art is now part of the language of freedom and democracy. Repressive, ideological regimes restrict artists. You must realise that art is not a choice made at secondary school. Rather, we are all cultural beings. You will be opposed by all people interested in art, design, free speech, freedom and democracy, and probably also by a few bankers and investors interested in British products and exports who are concerned about the colour of their money. Michael Gove, ditch EBAC, it is mistaken. Education is about sowing seeds, not setting standards for the shape of bananas. Bob and Roberta Smith, artist. And I read it at length because it gives... I sat yesterday trying to answer the question, all right, it's all right putting up a slide saying art makes children powerful, but in what ways does it make children powerful, Jonathan? You should have an answer to that, but I found it in that letter, so I hope you'll excuse me quoting it at length. But as we said, this is the Harold Rosen Third Memorial Lecture. And there is Harold. And although, you know, DARE is a day of celebrating the hopeful in education and the successes of artists, teachers and children in securing and growing spaces in the wilderness of public education for the arts and humanities, I wanted to begin by travelling with and honouring the legacy of Harold Rosen. On the 4th of October 1936, Harold and Connie Rosen joined the Battle of Cable Street to fight off fascism in London. He spent his adult life as a teacher of English, a public intellectual, a committed socialist who believed that English was first and foremost a cultural subject, the site of discovery, inquiry, and exploration of the human condition, a place of questioning, recognising, and doubting. His legacy includes the idea that the texts and discourses of the English classroom should be representative of the students in the classroom, the often invisible lives of working people, and the diversity of the world beyond the classroom. That also includes the idea that the English classroom should be a site for the critique of power and how it is realised in symbolic forms. For Harold Rosen, it was not enough for a child to be merely literate. They had to find their voice and they had to learn how to use it. And as a beginning English teacher in 1975, you know, hard times like these hard times, I entered this heady world of new ideas and forms of engagement. Harold was of a kind with Raymond Williams, Richard Hoggart, Stuart Hall and others, the apogee of the modernist intellectual ambition. And as a young teacher working in David Jackson's English department in Nottinghamshire, I was shaped by Rosen, Michael Halliday, Jimmy Britton, John Richmond, Nancy Martin, Peter Medwell, Janet Mabon and others who are probably now too old for most of the young people in this room to remember. But we all, as you know, stand on the shoulders of giants. I was inducted into a culture of English teaching which was based in the power of language and literature to create a more fair and equitable world, but also to create a world which provided both bread and roses. He lived the struggle of which Cable Street was made. He understood the power of the arts as forms of protest and celebration, as forms of inner and outer expression, as forms of meaning-making and reinvention. Which brings us to the title slide, Dramatic Futures, Why the Arts and Humanities Must Reclaim the Curriculum. You see that it shifted slightly. The original published title was Why the Arts and Humanities Should Reclaim the Curriculum, and as I wrote, I realised I needed to change it to must. The more I wrote, the more convinced I was this wasn't a moral imperative, it was an absolute imperative and necessity that we would do that. And I'm actually interested in that combination of the arts and the humanities. You know, for me, my life has been to try and combine those things. You know, as a Democrat, you know, I understand that some of the shapings of democracy go back to 5th century Athens, and something very clever happened in 5th century Athens. They created a political system which was largely exclusive. It excluded slaves, excluded women, it excluded people who weren't born in Athens or both parents weren't born in Athens. It was an exclusive, limited democracy. But what they brilliantly did was to invent theatre. Because in the theatre, you could see the lives of everybody. The rich, the poor, the slaves, the women, the children, everybody was represented on the stage. And for the Athenians, it was the power of politics, philosophy, and drama coming together, which was at the very core of the democratic perfectionist ideal that that we still seek for in our lives. So for me, to imagine drama or English or other arts separate from history, separate from social studies, separate from sociology, separate from anthropology, makes no sense. Because for me, the arts are wedded to our understanding, exploration, and expression of the human condition in ways that we seek to change people or at least to engage people in debates about the great questions of our age. But this is also a picture chosen because it is a picture of struggle. And as with any image, there are a number of levels to this one. It is a four boys restraining another as he struggles to break free. It is a group of 15-year-old students studying Shakespeare for GCSE. They are not sat at desks passively receiving authorised meanings from an authoritative teacher. They are actively, physically, playfully, and socially engaged in their learning. They are literally bringing themselves to Shakespeare. They are working on Romeo and Juliet at the point at which Mercutio taunts Tybalt into a fatal duel. The boy in the centre has a script in his hand and plays Mercutio. He will reach and kill Tybalt unless he is restrained. He is physically struggling against the restraints to get to Tybalt. Tybalt. Mercutio, thou consortest with Romeo. Consort? What? Dost thou make us minstrels? And thou make minstrels to us? Look to hear nothing but discords. Here's my fiddlestick. Here's that shall make you dance. Zounds, consort. And struggle is a theme. And I'm reminded of the words of Frederick Douglass, the freed slave and abolitionist, who in his autobiography wrote of struggle these words. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favour freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must also be a struggle. And in this sense, this work that these young people are doing, they're studying Shakespeare for GCSE, but they're doing more than that. They're part of an ambition to use all forms of education, but in my case, particularly the English classroom and the drama classroom, as a form of democratisation for young people, to try and create classrooms which mirror the characteristics of a democratising community. In other words, a classroom where rules are freely accepted rather than fearfully followed. A classroom in which children have the freedom to express and freely exchange ideas through argument. A classroom that gives all children the opportunity to participate in political discussion and so to be in a position to influence public choice. And a classroom which recognises people's determination to fight for political participation and an effective voice. As John Dewey reminded us at the turn of the last century, democracy must be born anew in every generation, and education is its midwife. And this was a central concern of Rosen's, to nurture democracy in the young through culture and cultural making, leading to a questioning of the world as it is. A keen sense of social history and the lives of working people conveyed through their voices and other forms of witnessing. A reimagining of how the world might be and how it might become so. At the heart of this project lay the idea of critique, choice and fairness. The tools that the English classroom offered were, in Terry Eagleton's words, a theoretical armoury for working class and minoritised people, to understand, in Terry Eagleton's words, their own condition more deeply, and so to acquire some of the theoretical armoury essential to change it. Some of you may have been to the British Museum exhibition of Shakespeare held last year, and you may have had the chance to see this book, which has become known as the Robben Island Bible, which is a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare that was smuggled in by Sonny Venkatharan into Robben Island. At the point that he went into Robben Island, prisoners were allowed one book, and harsher regimes came and all the books were confiscated. And one day Sonny found himself in a church meeting and was sent to go and get the hymnals or the whatever books, like songbooks, go and get songbooks out of the storeroom, and there he saw his complete works of Shakespeare. So he brought them out, smuggled them back to his room, he covered them in Vedantic drawings and images and devotional images, and persuaded the guides that it was his Bible. The fact that there is no Hindu Bible passed the guards by, but even so. And then this book was eagerly passed amongst the 39 Category B political prisoners, and was used by them as a source of inspiration to build a sense of political leadership which the ANC would then take into the world. What was interesting about it was that it was a secular text. So amongst the Jews, the Hindus and others, there was this common territory, this common text, if you like, which could be used to begin political education. And not just for the already educated political prisoners, but also for the common prisoners who were sent in to intimidate them. The robbers, the rapists, the arsonists who were sent in to terrify the political prisoners, who were illiterate, and some of whom came to read through Shakespeare as the only text that was available to them. And famously, Nelson Mandela signed against a speech from Caesar, "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once." And in his new book, Hamlet's Dreams, David Shalkwick describes the educational tradition that led to Shakespeare being the secular common denominator amongst the political prisoners, most of whom were educated in missionary schools like Lovedale, where Mandela and others were educated. And in those schools, there was a struggle between teachers who saw exposure to great Western literature in Leaversite and Arnoldian terms as a gentrifying end in itself. Whereas for the increasingly politicised student body, the only purpose of literature was to trigger and inform debate about the human condition and the body politic. Public readings leading to public debate around the great questions raised was the ontogenesis of revolution in South Africa. And this is, again, a familiar struggle in our own diverse and multicultural classrooms between the passive and uncritical imposition of literature, particularly Shakespeare, on young people, and the desire for English classrooms to be a site for struggle between different conceptions of power, identity, and the role of debate and free exchange of ideas in a democratising community. In a country which has erased speaking and listening from the curriculum, because as Nick Gibb, the Minister for Schools, argues, there is already too much waffle going on in our classrooms. And Mandela, of course, also reminds us that the free expression of ideas through critical and deliberative debate is not a Western invention. In his autobiography, The Long Walk to Freedom, he described how impressed he was as a young boy by the democratic nature of the proceedings of the local meetings that were held in his home village. He says, "Everyone who wanted to speak did so. It was democracy in its purest form. There may have been a hierarchy of importance among the speakers, but everyone was heard. Chief and subject, warrior and medicine man, shopkeeper and farmer, landowner and labourer. The foundation of self-government was that all men were free to voice their opinions and equal in their value as citizens." So as a teacher in that tradition, you know, what I try to do, whatever I'm teaching, is to try and recognise the central issues which confront young people in becoming democratising agents in the world. And those are the problems of political participation, the problems of dialogue, and the problems of public interaction, easy public interaction. You know, increasingly in our cities, we're living in an age of hyper-diversity, where yes, the cities are diverse, but they're not mixed or interactive necessarily. You know, we keep ourselves unto ourselves. So for me, the English class, the drama classroom in particular, is a place where we can ask young people as dramatic actors to also be social actors who engage together and participate in order to make things happen, in which there is dialogue between students and between teacher and students on an equal and fair basis, in which students are encouraged to interact with each other freely and sensitively. And in doing that, what I'm also trying to work towards is developing the three capabilities which Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum identify as being essential to a democratic future. And that is to have a generation of young people who think critically, who are able to transcend local loyalties and to approach world problems as a citizen of the world, and have the ability to imagine sympathetically the predicament of another person. And actually, sympathetically is not a good word for me. Richard Sennett describes the difference between sympathy and empathy by suggesting that sympathy is a hug, whereas empathy is deep understanding, even of people you do not disagree, you agree with, even with people that you do not like. Can you understand? Can you achieve what Barkin called the mutuality of difference, to recognise in you another human being and to recognise that we are the same because we are different, and to have a generation of young people who feel that, who can put themselves in the shoes of, and who can make decisions not in their own interest but in the interest of the common good, however we might define that, seems to me to be a critical aim for all educationists. Martha Nussbaum goes on to say, "It is all too easy to see another person as just a body, which we might then think we can use for our own ends, bad or good. It is an achievement to see a soul in that body, and this achievement is supported by poetry and the arts, which ask us to wonder about the inner world of that shape we see, and two, to wonder about ourselves and our own depths." But it's a struggle, isn't it? We find ourselves in hard times again, and we find ourselves with a government who again believes that all that we need is facts and that everything else should be rooted out. What I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the mind of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. And the problem with that, in terms of a democratic classroom, is that the facts that make up the record of knowledge becomes knowledge itself, rather than the cognitive tools and skills of discovery, inquiry, invention, and innovation which humankind has developed to create the facts of the record. It's not enough to know the facts. You have to know how the facts were made, and you have to know how to critique those facts, and you have to have the skills and the tools to be able to unpack, deconstruct, challenge, alter, make anew. Not facts, but new truths, new possibilities, new ambiguities. And of course, an emphasis on facts rather than the tools of creativity in our schools also reinforces inequalities, as we will see. Facts serve the powerful, of course, because they control what is fact and therefore beyond question. And they also decide which and whose facts are to be passively absorbed in our classrooms. Without the skills of imagination, inquiry, and invention, the powerless remain powerless. Learning and accepting facts handed down by an authority does not engage the powerless in the empowering skills of critical thinking, questioning, and challenging. And everybody in this room, of course, knows that the arts are important in all of that. We all know that the arts, for instance, create students who are more engaged citizens. And in America in particular, that research has gone to as far as you can get, longitudinal studies over two generations. Huge, huge studies of the like we've never seen in this country. And the results of that are very clear. Socially and economically disadvantaged children and teenagers have high levels of arts engagement, show more positive outcomes in a variety of areas than their low arts engaged peers. At-risk teenagers with a history of intensive arts experience show achievement levels closer to and in some cases exceeding the levels shown by the general population study. Most of the positive relationships between arts involvement and academic outcomes apply only to at-risk populations. So as everybody sitting in this room knows, that the children most likely to gain from high arts exposure are powerless children and are poor children, the children who need those advantages most. And we kind of know that, don't we? Or at least the powerful know that. Those of you who lived through creative partnerships and the dog days of the new Labour government will remember the ambition when we were going to spend everything that was left in the world to give every child in the country 5 hours a week of quality arts and culture. But look at what that list contained. You know, top quality theatre, museums, libraries, taking part in theatre, singing, creative writing, going to films, making a piece of visual arts or craft. All activities which are the birthright of the children of the powerful. You know, I have a child and she goes to the theatre and she goes to dance and she sings and she plays musical instruments because that's part of her home education. That is her birthright. And all that this new Labour experiment was trying to do was to offer all children that same birthright through schooling. And in doing so, to give them the chance to become powerful through the arts in the way that the American studies show us can be possible. But what has happened? This is from the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities, chaired by Michelle Obama. And their conclusions were that decades of research show strong and consistent links between high-quality arts education and a wide range of impressive educational outcomes. The arts have been yielding some particularly promising results in school reform and closing the achievement gap. Due to budget constraints and emphasis on the subjects of high-stakes testing, arts instruction in schools is on a downward trend. This is especially true for students from low-income schools where analysis show that access to the arts is disproportionately absent. One reason for this is the No Child Left Behind programme in America, which is not unlike what Gove is following here in England, which of course is laudable because it's absolutely essential that all children have access to the tools of literacy which they need in order to become powerful in their lives, but not at the expense of not being able to engage in the arts. So that in the 10-year period since No Child Was Left Behind was introduced, in year 2000, 20% of all secondary schools in America offered drama and dance. In the year 2010, only 3% of schools in America offer drama and dance to their students. Only 3% of schools in America offer dance and drama to children. And those 3% are in middle-class areas. So for the poor, and remember in America that poverty is increasingly racialized, there is almost no access to the arts in terms of your public education offer. And it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder, why are the powerless denied the power of the arts? And let us turn again to Frederick Douglass. The more I read, the more I was led to abhor and detest my enslavers. I could regard them in no other light than as a band of successful robbers who had left their homes and gone to Africa and stolen us from our homes and in a strange land reduced us to slavery. I loathe them as being the meanest as well as the most wicked of men. As I writhed under it, I would at times feel that learning to read had been a curse rather than a blessing. It had given me a view of my wretched condition without the remedy. It opened my eyes to the horrible pit, but to no ladder upon which to get out. In moments of agony, I envied my fellow slaves for their stupidity. I've often wished myself a beast. I preferred the condition of the meanest reptile to my own, and anything, no matter what, to get rid of thinking. Why are the powerless denied the power of the arts? You'll be able to make a similar map for your own art form, I'm sure, but here's one for drama. There was a possibility, particularly in some urban schools, that before 2011, you could have this as a free choice, you know, as a not paid for choice. You could have drama as a subject in the curriculum. You could have it as a means of teaching other subjects in the curriculum. There would be extracurricular clubs and performances. There would be youth theatre on offer to you. There was the opportunity for amateur drama. There was theatre and education and visiting artists coming into your schools. There was local and national theatre outreach. There was participating as an audience to live theatre made financially possible for you. And there was the opportunity for working class children to go on to conservatoire level dance and drama training. But those traffic lights show us what has happened. And even those ambers are beginning to go red. And the only two that remain green are extracurricular clubs and performances and amateur drama, because we do that willingly in our own time. Why are the powerless denied the power of the arts? The greatest threat to democracy, of course, is the growing inequality in the world, the gap between the richest and the poorest. This is a Gini coefficient. It's information that's collected by the CIA on every country. And what it does is to look at the gap between the richest and the poorest. So in the fairest society, you would have one, which meant that the money was perfectly distributed between the richest and the poorest. According to the CIA, anything over 0.40 is likely to lead to political and social instability. That's why the CIA keep these records. And you will notice that Britain is already perilously close to that figure, and the inequalities have massively grown since 1978. You will notice that China and America are already over the danger zone. We live in a world in which the wealth share of the middle quintile has increased 18% in real dollar terms during the last 50 years, while the wealth share of the top 5% has increased by 293%. The odds of a student in the middle class making as much money as his or her parents are 2 to 5. The odds of the top 5% becoming as wealthy as their parents are over 90%. So we're encouraging children to participate in a world which has become increasingly unequal, where they must feel that their opportunity both to be someone in that world and to change that world decrease. And of course, the consequences of apex predatory capitalism, hell-bent on a zero-sum exchange with the financial markets, are social and collective as well. At certain levels of visible inequality and desperation, there will be political and social instability, as we are now seeing in many parts of the world, including England. We're also asking young people to put the common interest before their own selfish self-interest. It's absolutely core to the idea of democracy that we put the interests of the powerless before the interests of the powerful, that we put the interests of the people before our own clan or family loyalty. But what examples do young people have of that? I could have updated this, but it's shocking enough as it is. You know, they live in the world where household brands are stealing, are nakedly pursuing their own self-interests. It's difficult to see where the role models might come for young people to say, put the common good before your own naked self-interest. And these matters are of concern to us as arts educators and as humanitarians. We also know that there is a corrosion of public sympathy and public empathy going on, that most people now question whether there should be increases in spending on benefits. More people are more sceptical about whether benefit recipients deserve the help they receive. and most people want to see a reduction in overall immigration. So there is a marked corrosion of public empathy. Again, one of the cornerstones of a democratic life. Why are the powerless denied the power of the arts? And there are other attacks as well. You may be familiar with Arizona House Bill 2281, which prohibits instruction in any Arizona public or charter school that promotes the overthrow of the US government, fair enough, promotes resentment towards a race or class of people, fair enough, or is designed primarily for students of a particular ethnic group or advocates ethnic solidarity. It bans Mexican-American studies in schools for these reasons. Primarily, it banned Mexican-American studies in schools because Mexican-American studies encouraged Mexican-American students to see themselves as Mexican-Americans, even though those students who followed the course did much better in grades in other subjects as well. It also bans more than 80 books, which include Pedagogy of the Oppressed and The Tempest. So we're back to Shakespeare as the political text. And if that's not spine-chilling enough, let's look what's happening in Texas. The Texas Republican Party Manifesto 2012, they are now in power, seeks to ban the teaching of higher order thinking skills from the curriculum. It seeks to ban the teaching of higher order thinking skills in classrooms. If you read that description, my suspicion is that everybody in this room who is an educator in order to do that. But you would now be banned from doing that in Texas because you would challenge the student's fixed belief and undermine parental authority. I kind of thought that was my job. Obviously, I'm not giving many keynotes in Texas these days. How long have I got? Quarter of an hour. A bit less, maybe. And in Europe as well. This is a picture of 20 new Golden Dawn MPs being sworn in to the Houses of Parliament in Athens by giving a fascist salute. This is 2012, my friends. This is 2012 in mainland Europe. Harold Rosen, 4th of October, 1936, the Battle of Cable Street. And here we are. One of the Golden Dawn's principles is that if you do not agree with us, you belong to a different race. But Golden Dawn have also learnt the lessons of community activism. They provide food for the hungry, protection for the elderly and the vulnerable, security from the threat of the foreigner. They've worked up from the community to Parliament. The favourite band to play at Golden Dawn political gatherings is a band called Pogrom, whose hits include Auschwitz and Speak Greek or Die. Why are the powerless? And what is our role? And what is the role of arts educators? These are the requirements of a democracy. These are also, I think, the hallmarks of a good arts classroom, whether it's a drama one, a visual arts or a music classroom. That in the best classrooms, what we find is a public space constituted, contracted, negotiated for participatory and deliberative speech. We decide with students what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, what rules we're going to live by, how we're going to interact with each other, the importance of restraint of speech and action in order to allow freedom of ideas to be communicated. We stress the importance of the equality of participation in the public sphere, that we are all artists in this space, we can all make, we all have a right to be here and to do so. We encourage freedom of speech and the right to criticism. We negotiate rules that are freely accepted. We encourage disinterested speech and action, and we develop the empathetic imagination. This is the new theoretical armoury that children need in order to resist those anti-democratic forces that are there in the world and growing as we sit here and speak. Some time ago, the poet Brian Patton wrote a poem during, it wasn't Chris Patton the minute, who was he? It wasn't Chris Patton, was it?
John
who was the, sorry?
John Patton.
Yeah. John, but he wasn't his brother though, was he? Somebody told me he was his brother, but I don't think he was. John Patton was the Minister for Exams, and this looks like enlightened times compared to the times we're living through now. And he wrote a poem which I rediscovered recently, which is, for now, you know, a savage poem, you know, a rage poem, more than a dare poem. And I thought I'd read it to you again and recover it. It's called The Minister of Exams. And he wrote this because he remembered being at school and going to a careers office, and the careers officer saying, what do you want to be? And he said, I want to be a poet. And the careers officer said to him, you were born into the wrong kind of family. When I was a child, I sat an exam. This test was so simple, there was no way I could fail. Question one, describe the taste of the moon. It tastes like creation, I wrote. It has the flavour of starlight. Question two, what colour is love? Love is the colour of the water a man lost in the desert finds, I wrote. Question three, why do snowflakes melt? I wrote, they melt because they fall onto the warm tongue of God. There were other questions. They were as simple. I described the grief of Adam when he was expelled from Eden. I wrote down the exact weight of an elephant's dream. Yet today, many years later, for my living, I sweep the streets or clean out the toilets of the fat hotels. Why? Because constantly I failed my exams. Why? Well, let me set a test. Question one. How large is a child's imagination? Question two, how shallow is the soul of the Minister for Exams? I haven't got time to develop it, but bizarrely, perversely perhaps, you know, part of the answer for me lies in play, you know, in serious forms of play. You know, play is part of the human DNA. It precedes culture. It's necessary for human evolution and survival. Our genes know that. It's particularly important in terms of socialising ourselves and living in the world with others. Those of you who are parents know that. You will have seen your child in the playground or on the beach, edging towards strangers and finding in play a commonplace, a space between, which is not full of fear of the other, is full of joy and curiosity and wonder. You will have seen them negotiating a temporary culture. I have in my house a little six-year-old. Next door is a four-year-old boy and a 10-year-old boy. We have an alley outside the house which is gated, so it's a fairly safe place. Out in that space last summer, hasn't been enough of this summer for this to happen again, but last summer, these children of different ages created for themselves a temporary culture in order to play, in which the strongest made exception for the weakest, in which the oldest gave advantage to the youngest, in which the oldest looked out for the youngest, didn't try to exploit them, and they happily played together and lived together throughout the summer. And yet when those same children went into the playground, they pretended they didn't know each other. Because you don't want everybody to know you've been spending your time with a four-year-old, do you? But the wonderfulness of it was that in order to overcome that strangeness, in order to be safe together, they had to find forms of social play in order to negotiate and make that safe for themselves. And that, I believe, is at the heart of all art making, but it's also at the heart of what young people need to preserve and continue if they're to rescue the world that we have made from them. And not only that, look at the qualities that Jerome Bruner reminds us of playful learners, the kind of playful learners that we have in the arts. You see, what people say about arts research is, oh, you can't show that there are any causal links. You can't prove scientifically, because the world is science-shaped, obviously, that engagement in the arts leads to more engaged citizens. It might be something else. Well, it might be. But what I believe is that in all forms of art, there is this sense of playmaking, and it is that sense of playmaking which is the causal link between a happy, successful society and fascism. And in any case, in the future, what kind of learners do we want? Aren't these the kind of learners that we want? When those workers went into the Fukushima nuclear reactor, when it had been blown to bits by the tsunami, what kind of learners did you want? Ones who had the facts? Ones who would follow the rule book? The rule book was ripped up. Did you want learners, workers going in there who were easily frustrated? Did you want learners and workers who would stick with the solution even though they knew it wasn't working? It's difficult to get anybody to take place seriously, but I absolutely believe it is core to the survival of the species as we look forward to an uncertain future. You know, an uncertain future in which, as a grey-haired man, I have a world to pass on to the youngest children, but they may, in all seriousness, for the first time in human history, not have a world to pass on to their grandchildren. And yet, as I said, we have to have hope in all of that, and we have to have courage and dignity in what we do as a teacher. And I'm going to give you one more reading before I finish, which is from Gary Paulson's book, Night John, which is about a child growing up in slavery and her attempts to learn how to read and how she was helped by a man called Night John to do so. And he taught her the alphabet letter by letter. So she's just learned the letter A and now she's going to learn the letter B. B, he said it, B, B. That sounds crazy. That's how you say the letter B. It's for bet or beat or boo or boo. That's how a B looks and how you make the sound. I made it sound in my mouth, whispering, so where's the bottom to it? I swear, you always want to know the bottom to things. Here it is. It sits on itself this way, facing, so the two round places push to the front. Suddenly, he's gone. One second he's there, the next he's slammed sideways and gone. What in the hell are you doing to her? Mammy was standing there, big and black and tall in the moonlight. What are you doing to this girl? She had come from the side and fetched John such a blow on his head that it knocked him back into the wall and on his back. He came up quick and didn't cower none. Nothing, not like you think. I'm teaching her to read. That's what I mean, Mammy said. What in the hell are you doing? Don't you know what they do to her if they find her trying to read? We already got one girl tore to pieces by the whip and the dogs. We don't need two. I've been quiet all this time watching. Didn't seem so bad what he was doing, teaching me a few letters to know, maybe a word or two. So I said it. Doesn't seem too bad. Bad! Then she hissed like a snake. Child, they'll cut your thumbs off if you learn to read. They'll whip you until your back looks knitted, until it looks like his back. She pointed to John, big old finger. Is that how you got whipped? He shook his head. I ran and got caught. Not the first time. She waited. I waited. First time I ran, I got a clean away. I went north all the way. I was free. I'd never heard such a thing. We couldn't even talk about being free. And here was a man said he'd been free by running north. I thought, how can that be? You ran and got away? Mammy asked. I did. You ran until you were clean away? I did. And you came back? I did. Why? He sighed, and it sounded like his voice, like his laugh, low and way off thunder. It made me think he was going to promise something, the way thunder promises rain. For this. What do you mean, this? To teach reading. It's a proud profession. We should go proudly with hope and make a better world. Thank you for listening.